The Tom Woods Show, episode 527.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome. Glad you could join me today. We're going to be talking about a subject that, well, does come up from time to time in our circles. We do have to deal with it. Critics use this argument all the time. Left-wing sites use it all the time, but you know, even so-called respectable conservative sites will sometimes come after you with this. And that's to say that Austrian economics, which we believe in and talk about on this show, the Austrian School of Economics, is unscientific because it doesn't engage in econometric analysis and use formal mathematics in its material and in its analysis. And this is supposed to be evidence that we're unscientific, we're dogmatic. We shouldn't be taken seriously because we just don't care what the real world is saying because we've got our nice little theory. Well, as you may have gathered, that may not be altogether the fairest way of thinking about the Austrian approach, so I thought we'd talk about it, and we'll also talk about it in connection with the famous Brian Kaplan article that we've been talking about bit by bit over the past several months, Why I Am Not an Austrian Economist. Brian is a libertarian, for sure, and I've talked to him on the show before. But we've been going through his article, Why I Am Not an Austrian Economist, and he does have a section on method, although he's not at his most combative in the section on method. So we'll use that just as a, you know, we'll use this as an opportunity to get to that section of the article for the sake of completeness. But I really do want to just talk about, in general, this kind of complaint against the Austrian school. And the best person to talk to about this is Jeff Herbener. And Jeff is the chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College, and he is associate editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and of course, he teaches economics at my Liberty Classroom, which is where you can get the whole thing step by step from scratch. You can learn, you can become a master of this stuff if you just take the time to listen to the stuff in your car and maybe do a little reading when you have time, but you can learn it systematically, and Jeff knows everything there is to know, and I'm not joking about that, and you can ask him all the questions you want for a whole year. Just keep pelting him with questions, and he comes up with answers. That's what I do. I just pelt him with questions all day, and he comes up with answers. I don't know how he does it. It's ridiculous. Anyway, check that out at libertyclassroom.com using coupon code SHOW in all caps for a special listener discount. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
We're still talking about Kaplan's article, but this is a topic we could, of course, be talking about on its own, and I think for a good chunk of our discussion, we'll do that. This is an objection that a lot of people come up against, and especially when people are new to the Austrian school, they don't really know how to answer it. When people say to them, you Austrians aren't scientific, you're not like other economists who put aside their ideological predispositions and they just sit there and look at the facts, or they engage in some kind of econometric analysis that you have for your own ideological or strange methodological reasons ruled out. So you're not scientific, you're just dogmatic. You've got certain views that aren't based on empirical evidence and observation, and this is the very opposite of the scientific method. It's the very sort of analysis that the modern world has been so fortunate to move away from, and now you want to take us back to heaven knows what age from the past. Okay, that is really what people do here. So I want you to talk to us about that a little bit today, about the Austrian method, about praxeology, about the method that Ludwig von Mises considered to be appropriate to economics, and why this is not so-called unscientific. Why don't we start off with that very word, scientific versus unscientific, and try and understand what that really means. When we say something is scientific or not scientific, how should an economist think about these terms?
Right. So we can start with that. Murray Rothbard liked to point out that the root of the word science just comes from, just means in English, knowledge. And so to be scientific just means to discover truth about the world. And as the as he held, and as Austrians who follow him hold, depending on the subject matter that we're investigating as scientists, it might be that it requires different methods to plumb the depths of understanding in these areas. And so it's always been the Austrian view that to understand what's true and correct about human action requires a method that is different from the hypothesis testing method of the natural sciences. And the reason for this is precisely because the subject matter itself is different. We're dealing with human action in the realm of economics. And in the natural sciences, we're dealing with inanimate objects, or at least maybe in the realm of biology, with living things that don't act as human beings do. And so I think that's the basic starting point for discussion of the Austrian view versus this neoclassical approach, which accepts the hypothesis testing method as appropriate for human action, for discovering truth about the social world of human beings.
Let's try and take a specific example. I mean, it can be you can just devise a hypothetical, but show me what a neoclassical economist would do in this regard that an Austrian would find objectionable. What would be an assumption or an approach or an example of a hypothesis that might be tested in this way, where the approach would offend our methodological sensibilities?
Well, I think almost any example of a claim about a law of economics would suffice. So let's say we wanted to look at the Austrian approach to discovering the law of demand versus the neoclassical approach. So the neoclassical approach would be to treat the law of demand as a quantitative relationship that would be found in empirical evidence over time as to the price of a good and the quantity purchase that buyers make at various prices. So they would gather.
Okay, so just state the law of demand for people.
Yeah, so the law of demand would say that only at lower prices do people buy more of a good. So price and quantity purchased by the buyers is inversely related. And so they would gather up a big data set and look at the empirical evidence in some particular market, the gasoline market or whatever it is, and see whether or not there was a correlation when prices go down. Do we actually see the quantity purchase go up? And when prices go up in this market over time, do we actually see the quantity purchase go down? And there are two kinds of objections that Austrians make to this procedure. One we might call theoretical, and the other is historical. So the theoretical objection is, when the Austrians talk about laws of human action, we're not speaking about empirically testable hypotheses. We're speaking about a different body of knowledge that can be logically inferred from the very nature of human action, the very nature of the fact that people have ends and strive to attain these ends with the application of means. And all of the knowledge that we have about human action that we can ascertain because we are human beings, and we can reflect upon the nature of our action. So if an Austrian wants to develop the law of demand, he would start with just logical propositions about ends and means, noticing that gasoline could be used as a means to attain ends, and that having attained the most valuable ends with a given amount of gasoline, only less valuable ends can be attained with additional quantities of gasoline. And for that reason alone, people would be willing to pay less to purchase these additional gallons of gasoline. This is not an empirically testable proposition, but is simply a logical inference from the economizing behavior of human beings. And then the second problem with the testing empirically the hypothesis about the law of demand is that historical events are complex. There are a multitude of different causal factors that enter into the generation of the data of human action, and there isn't any known objective way to disentangle all of these effects, or as Mises and Rothbard like to put it, there are no constants in the quantitative data of human action, in the relationships of these quantitative data sets. So it isn't possible to formulate mathematically a functional expression that that can be tested with empirical data.
Well, it seems hard to imagine that neoclassical economists haven't at least anticipated or addressed these types of objections somewhere. For instance, let's start with the objection that human beings are not inanimate objects and they have wills and so on. It seems unlikely that they don't see that, but do they think that's not worth worrying about, or they think they've somehow factored that in? What would they say?
Well, as far as I understand it, the only answer to inquiries like this is that they believe that it's the scientific method, the natural science method, is the only way to get at these quantitative relationships, and that if this requires them to construct certain abstract models that aren't consistent with the nature of real human beings, then so be it. The proof of their usefulness would be in the results that we get. But the Austrians' response to this is, of course, that we do have a method of dealing with the complexity of historical events, and this is the standard method of the historian, is to use human judgment to assess the relevance of each of the causal factors in terms of the quantitative effect that it has on the outcome.
But what about the claim that we can't figure out which factor, given that there are so many factors at work in a complex economy? If we increase the minimum wage, there are many factors at work. So we can't say, well, increasing the minimum wage has such and such effect, and I know it because I observed the effects. There are many, many things, some of them that will accentuate the effects of the minimum wage, some of them that will work at cross purposes with it. There's no way to disentangle that. But don't they think they have some way of doing that? And then secondly, can you explain to me what a regression is? We hear economists say, well, I ran a regression and I found such and such. I'd also like to know about that.
Sure. So let's deal with that first, since that is the technique they use to disentangle the causal effects.
Right. So, yeah, doesn't that work?
Yeah. So here's the problem, here's how the procedure works. So what's done is that the economist would write out a functional relationship, write out a functional equation that has an independent variable that they're trying to ascertain as causally connected to a dependent variable. And so with a minimum wage, it would be the raising of the minimum wage, and then there would be other sorts of causal factors that they would identify through various means that they would put into the function. And in the function, then, there, of course, will be these variables, these independent variables that affect the dependent causally, they claim, and there would be constants. And what the econometric analysis, what the statistical analysis does, is to divide, to correlate the different changes in the each of the independent variables with the changes in the dependent. And then the correlations are used to make quantitative estimates of these constants. And although Kaplan doesn't seem to recognize this, the main objections that Austrians make to this procedure is there are no constants in the quantitative relationships of data that's generated through human action. And therefore, the whole apparatus is of establishing a function and then saying they're constants of unknown magnitude, and we use the regression to estimate the quantitative magnitude of the constants is inappropriate.
So what then is appropriate? What would be your, let's say, 5-minute explanation of the Austrian approach in the tradition of Mises?
Right. Here, the approach, as Mises laid it out in his book Theory and History, is to use our own human judgment to assess, given the structure of causal factors, what their quantitative magnitude is. So, for example, if we had, let's say, the Great Depression, and we wanted an economic history of the Great Depression, then the Austrian approach would be to identify the causal factors from theory, like monetary inflation and credit expansion of the 1920s, and then other causal factors that would be involved in prolonging the Depression, like various wage propping up measures by the Hoover administration and the change of business confidence toward uncertainty and so on and so forth, and then just make an assessment as to how important these factors were in the actual outcome of the Great Depression as it played out. So, for example, a standard Austrian view would be that the financial downturn of 29 to 33 was brought about by the collapse of the previous monetary inflation and credit expansion. So we had the asset price inflation in the late 20s and then the corresponding collapse. But the prolonging of the Great Depression into the mid-30s and then later 30s, the main cause here was the uncertainty of investment projects on the part of capitalists. And you can, again, find data to indicate this, the suppression of actual investment spending and so on. And then unemployment, of course, would be explained primarily by the falling of the purchasing power of money at the same time that wages were being propped up by various measures of governments.
All right, let's turn our attention now to Kaplan. Now, he doesn't have so much to say in this section that I think is super critical for us to analyze, but just for the sake of completeness, we'll look at it. He notes in, and by the way, of course, the Kaplan article, it will be at the show notes page, tomwoods.com/527. He says that it's true. He does share some of the Mises-Rothbard criticisms of neoclassical methodology. So he's not altogether opposed to what they're saying. But he says that Austrians reject econometrics on principle because economic theory is true a priori, so statistics or historical study cannot test theory. Fair enough, but econometrics and other empirical work can play a more modest role to help determine how big or trivial various theoretically relevant factors actually are. Is that a point that can be conceded?
Well, I don't think we can concede it entirely. We might, in the best way, think of it like this, that, of course, when someone's interested in the history of some period, they want to look at empirical evidence. But the question of the magnitude of effects can't be settled by running correlations. Maybe this is clear, by the way, if we make another application of this method of history that Mises makes. Mises points out that this method of specific understanding, as he called it, was also the method used by entrepreneurs to make anticipations of the future. And here it seems pretty clear that if one is to make the most accurate prediction of the future, they would not merely rely upon correlations of data sets in the past, but this of necessity would require that empirical knowledge of the past to be judged by the entrepreneur before the entrepreneur says, okay, well, now I think the future will work out with the magnitudes being such and such.
Okay, but could we use, just for sake of argument, couldn't we use empirical study and just rolling up our sleeves and going out and investigating stuff to try to figure out, I mean, I understand that entrepreneurs, there is this misconception that entrepreneurs just have all these just brute facts, and they look at these facts and a conclusion just pops out, and then they follow the conclusion. I get that is the wrong way to think about entrepreneurship. But couldn't we use empirical evidence, empirical study, let's say, of history, to try to understand, as you were indicating, the depth of the depression of the 1930s? That, well, maybe fiscal policy, or maybe these different programs of the New Deal may have held it back, and that helps to bolster what we understand through theory.
Right. So I think that is right. I think Kaplan would agree that that's right. I think the point of contention is whether or not the technique of econometrics provides us with essential knowledge that we couldn't acquire more accurately in a different way. I think that's the point of contention. So do we, we absolutely have to do the empirical work to find out what the conditions were, and then use the empirical work to judge the magnitude of effects. But whether econometric correlations are necessary in that process, that I think is debatable.
Kaplan gives 10 different areas that he thinks are interesting and some of the best new ideas to come out of academic economics over the past 65 years or so, or since the publication of Human Action. And he concedes, again, he's more skeptical of formal mathematics and econometrics than most economists are. And he lists all these contributions to economics, and he says, although formal math was the main language used to present these ideas in academic journals, it's not clear that math was really instrumental in the discovery of these ideas. And he says econometrics, their contributions to economics are similarly meager. So he says that mathematics and econometrics have had 50 years of ever-increasing hegemony in economics. The empirical evidence on their contribution is decidedly negative. So he's sympathetic. But then he goes on to say, this does not mean, however, that working economists ought to immediately cease to employ, and he calls them M and E, in their work. This has been the Austrians' main response, that, in other words, that they should cease to employ them. And it has led to their extreme isolation from the rest of the economics profession. The simple fact is that mathematics and econometrics are the language of modern economics, much as Latin was the language of medieval philosophy. These professional languages waste a lot of time and make it difficult for laymen and academics to communicate. But once mastered, even dissident scholars can use these tools to speak their minds. How does that strike you?
Well, yeah, there are a couple of things that strike me about that. I don't think it's entirely correct, or at least it's not a good analogy to say that mathematics is a language. Mathematics is a system of logic, and whether or not this system of logic can be directly applied to the discovery of knowledge with respect to human action is the open question. I think we would all agree that in order to apply mathematical logic in these models that the neoclassical economists use, they have to make assumptions that are entirely heroic. They assume economic agents. They assume certain abilities of these agents with respect to their utility assessments and functional representations of these things that we talked about before. And so, in a way, their beginning point is anti-empirical. And so when they get their result through mathematical logic, they have to translate it back into verbal logic to make their case for applying it to real human action. And that, it seems to me, is just as problematic as using verbal logic straight out and just working through the normal logical a set of arguments and arriving at a conclusion about human action.
Let me just give you a flat-out objection, just the basic gut-level objection that somebody might have to the whole Austrian approach. And it's a gut-level objection that I think even some sympathizers have, or some young people who are just learning it. They feel funny about it, and it's this. Suppose the subject of the minimum wage comes up, and you hear people saying, well, we have these new studies, and they seem to show that modest increases in the minimum wage anyway don't have employment effects really worth worrying about. And the Austrian in the conventional view, is basically just sitting there with his fingers in his ears saying, well, I don't care what your stupid studies say because I already know the answer. How can you make that not seem as bad as it sounds when I just described it?
Well, I think the appropriate Austrian response to the studies is not that we can dismiss them, so to speak. We can dismiss the empirical evidence that they contain, but simply that we have to see theoretically that certain stipulations were in place, certain conditions were in place in the real world, that the theory, the sort of straight answer that we give from the theory that raising the minimum wage would cause unemployment to go up, those conditions in the real world that we did not stipulate in that theoretical expression were in fact enforced in the real world. So there were certain things that occurred in the real world that, as you said before, either augmented or diminished the ceteris paribus claim that we make about higher minimum wages leading to a lower quantity demand of labor.
Okay, what I want to ask, what I want to leave with is, for people who want to know this better, really want to understand the Austrian position better, you can, of course, read the beginning sections of Human Action, but you may find them difficult. My two favorite treatments of this subject offhand, in addition to conversations with Jeff Herbener, would be Hans's piece, it's an essay, but it's also in a monograph form, Economic Science and the Austrian Method. But secondly, interestingly enough, the thing published by the Mises Institute years ago, has the word praxeology in it. I can't remember the title offhand. I'll put it at tomwoods.com/527, but it's written by George Selgin. You know the essay I have in mind.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really good overview of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else I should add, for the beginner to get his feet wet on this, apart from those two pieces?
No, I think those are, it's a funny thing that Austrian economists really don't actually spend much time writing about method. It's sort of odd.
We're accused of being obsessed with it, right?
Right, but actually we don't write very much about it, so it's sort of hard to find pieces on this. We're actually doing economics. That's what we're interested in.
Yeah, we're too busy doing that instead of this meta stuff about how somebody should do economics. We're just out doing it.
Right.
Yeah, how about that? So we don't really have anything comparable. Well, do we have anything comparable to the Friedman 1953 Friedman article on method that he and the Chicago people used? Like, what would be our comparable thing? I mean, there are Misesian books on epistemology, but it's not quite the same.
No, it's not the same. Roderick Long has that great critique of Friedman.
Yeah, you know what? Let me put that on there too. Yeah. It's he's got Friedman versus Mises kind of article, and it's like an Aristotelian. I know exactly the piece you mean. It's from the QJ,
right?
Yeah. I'll put Roderick's piece on there. Yeah, that really helped me to understand things quite a bit better, actually, too.
Mm.
And yeah, they were very good criticisms of Friedman from a philosopher. So I enjoyed that. Okay, so those three pieces. If you've read Roderick Long, Hans Hoppe. And it's funny to be recommending Hans Hoppe and Roderick in the same sentence. and George Selgin. What a funny three people. But honestly, they are at their best in this material. You really almost know all you need to know. And then if you want to spend your time reading epistemological works of Mises, then you get a gold star and extra credit. But this stuff will really, really give you everything you need. All right, Jeff. Well, thanks for doing this. I mean, this is difficult stuff, and we get this this criticism all the time that we're not scientific, but it's an equivocation surrounding the word scientific. And, Aristotle from the beginning made clear that you have a different method based on the nature of the subject matter that you're studying. That's just a fact, that you don't use the same method in geometry that you use in chemistry or that you use in physics, and that you just have to determine what the nature of the field you're studying is. And the appropriate method will follow from that. And that's what we're trying to say, and maybe not with as much success as we'd like, but doggone it, we're saying it. Jeff, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody. What we talked about just now and those different sources, as I said, will be linked at the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/527. So if you've ever been confused about this material, those sources, which are not that long, by the way, it won't take you that long to read them, will really clear up a lot of things for you. And chances are they're the only things you'll ever need to read on this subject. Of course, you can remember, you can ask Jeff all the questions you want, plus get all 14 on-the-go courses, which will help you when you are in that inevitable situation where you're surrounded by people who disagree and there are so many of them, and are you really going to know how to answer every objection? Well, with our courses that you can listen to on the go, you will become much more knowledgeable than anybody who's going to go up against you. And plus, even if you do get cornered and you don't know what to say, then just come running to our Q&A forums and we'll tell you what the answer is, and then you can go back and win. So it's lots of fun. We got Bob Murphy's going to have a course coming out very soon. It'll be course number 15 for us, and we have not raised the price from when we had only four courses. Come on! LibertyClassroom.com, coupon code SHOW in all caps. Tomorrow, I'm going to be doing the show all by myself, no guest. I've got several interesting topics we're going to cover that I think you'll like. A couple of follow-up things on previous episodes, controversial episodes. I've got more information. I've got even stingier arguments and retorts to make. So it's sort of like a jerk store. But I don't know how many of you are even old enough to remember Seinfeld, for heaven's sake. You remember the shrimp and all that? Anyway, if I have to explain it, it's not as funny. But anyway, I've got some things that I want to cover. Again, I've been reading this new Thomas Sowell book, and it's tremendous. So I want to share with you some of the nuggets that I got out of that. Let's see. What was the other thing? Oh, yeah, and I want to update you on this big project I'm working on. Like, well, I don't know why I don't stop doing this. I can't stop myself. I have to have a big project that I'm working on the side. And I've been working on what I've now gotten the design back for it to see what the homepage looks like, and it is just beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful. It's a website about how you can earn money online without scams. Go ahead and type in earn money online into Google and see what happens to you. But of course you can earn money online. I mean, that's what I do. A ton of people do that. But unfortunately, it's also an area where the scammers are everywhere. So I want to show people actual ways to earn money online, doing actual things, not click your mouse three times and you'll earn $100,000 a month. I was actually in a forum recently, one of these online marketing forums, and I'm not joking. Somebody came in and said, I'd like to earn $100,000 a month, but I don't really want to develop a product and I don't even really want to work that much. What do you recommend? I mean, it was just insane. But the poor guy is basically reading all these crazy hyped up sales pages, you know, for to sell him all these get-rich-quick products, and thinks this is a normal question to ask. But, of course, there are ways to earn money online. You could write a book. You could write an ebook, for instance. That's a way to earn money online. You can earn money through a podcast if you really, really work at it. You can earn money through blogging if you really work at it and if you have a plan before you start. There are a variety of things you can do to earn money online. You can earn money online as an affiliate marketer. There are so many things you can do, and they don't have to be full-time things, but there are things that you can do that can earn a little bit of money on the side, and I've just learned a whole lot of them. So now when people have conversations with me, it turns to this, because I always want to tell people, look, you're so close to doing X, Y, and Z, which would help you a lot. Look, this is all you have to do. I'm just full of these ideas. I'm always thinking of new things and finding new things and new tools to make my online work go more smoothly and easier and so on. So I'm really interested in this stuff, and I've done it myself. You know, I've self-published a book, and then I've done free ebooks on my own. I've done that, did that myself with no publisher. So I can, if you're interested in doing that, I can explain to you how to do it, because I actually went to the trouble to do it. So I'm going to explain things that I myself have done on this site and share that knowledge and all this basic information. I guess to a beginner it wouldn't be basic, but to me it's gotten to be sort of basic, will be available for free. It's just something I'm going to enjoy doing. I want to do things that I enjoy doing. And I've gotten down to a routine with the podcast where, for the most part, we're scheduling it, we're getting it done on a regular basis in advance so that I can be as efficient as possible with my time. And this has freed me up to work on projects that I hope will, I hate that expression, give back, but that will be helpful to those of you who, you know, maybe would like to look into earning a little bit of extra money online through these various means. And I just go through and show you what's worked for me. And, you know, what hasn't worked for me? That's another piece. I've been, as one person puts it, it's like I've been the crash test dummy of these things. I'll let you know what works and what doesn't. So I'm going to update you on that. I've been talking way too long in the conclusion for this episode. So if anybody is still listening, thank you so much for being with me today, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.